Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's the place where you'll find a link to the chat room. That's where all the usual suspects are already falling in. If you have some observations during the course of the show you'd like to make, or even better, even though Eagle One and I have about 12 hours of questions for Eric, doesn't mean you don't have a better one than we have. Go ahead and suggest a question in the chat room. We'll be more than glad to steal it from you. And if you're new to the show and you'll catch up on previous shows, or if what happens occasionally for those that are with us live, right at the 60-minute mark, the audio will die, but the recorder keeps going. We may have an after show for a few minutes where we just want to get one more question in, or we just want our guest to be able to finish the question that he's asking. We'll give him a chance to do that. You can click right over to the archive at Blog Talk Radio and snag it, where you can also get all of our previous episodes going back 232, now that we're on 233. Now let's get on with the show. That's why everybody's here. When you look at not just here in the USA, but Europe, Russia especially lately, down to the South China Sea and all the nations that have interest in those areas, when you look at what they're trying to do in a maritime sense, you can listen to what their media says, you can read their published maritime strategies, but really it's what they're building and where they're investing money that will really tell you the story. And that will tell you what capabilities they think they need to expand and what capabilities they're just letting drift away, either because that no longer is a requirement of theirs or they had to cut something and that's what their lowest priority. And for the full hour today, we're bringing on, I think, one of the best guests we could have to discuss this and a little bit more. That is Eric Wertheim, returning guest. Eric is a defense consultant, columnist, and an author specializing in naval and maritime issues. He was named to take the helm of the internationally acknowledged and kind of the Bible for many of us, the Naval Institute's reference document, Combat Fleets of the World. He took over that in 2002. And just about 10 months ago, we also came out with the 16th edition of that. Eric, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you for having me again. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you on board. Just as a side note, I can embarrass you. For those that are on the show page, if you look at our slideshow going on, you'll see a couple of pictures of Eric's attractive mug up there. If you do find yourself skulking around a Naval Institute conference or meeting or something, keep an eye open for Eric. And go ahead and corner him. He's always a hail fellow, well met when you get him in a social environment. I put you on the spot there, Eric, but I always wanted to encourage people because it seems like when I do make a chance, you are at those events, and I do enjoy our conversations.
Thanks. I've been going to them for probably over 20 years now. So the Naval Institute has been really a home away from home for me, and it's a great organization. And they began helping me with my career, and I have been working with the organization for two decades now. So it's great, and I try and attend as many of their meetings as I can.
And just for the help of our newer listeners, I mentioned in the intro that just about 10 months ago we put out the 16th edition of Combat Fleets of the World. Some people may not be familiar with the tome, so to speak. So just take a minute, tell everybody, you know, what is the Combat Fleets of the World, and, you know, what are the events that took place you all decided in 2013 that it was time to go ahead and push out a 16th edition of it?
Yeah, absolutely. The Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets of the World originally dates back over 100 years now to originally it was a French book, Floats to Combat, and this really was on the bridge of French warships, you know, through World War One, and sailed with the fleets in World War Two and the Cold War. And starting in the 1970s, the U.S. Naval Institute decided that this publication was worth translating into English. So about 1976-77, the first U.S. edition, which was a direct translation of Floats to Combat, came out. And every few years after that, a new edition would come out. My predecessor, Dave Baker, took over the book through the early 80s and through the 1980s and 90s, kind of turned the book a little, added more information and more details than the French book had. And by the time that I took over the book in 2002, it had really, the English language edition had morphed into a very separate book, and we still have a great relationship with our French sister publication, and we share a lot of information and photos and things like that. But we take a lot of pride in the differences and uniquenesses that put Combat Fleets of the World as the, you know, world's preeminent reference book on naval and maritime capabilities. It's really a Bible of the world's ships, the world's encyclopedia, if you will, on navies, and includes all their ships, aircraft, and systems. And it's not just navies, it's Coast Guards, got information on Marine Corps information. So if you want to look up a naval missile, a naval radar, it's really all in there. But of course, the most important part of the book, the real meat of it, is data on the world's ships and warships and supply ships and all the types of things like that. And so, as you said, in 2013, the latest edition came out. It's the 16th edition of, and that's the 16th edition of the U.S. Version, the English language edition. And we really decided that it had been 5 years since the previous edition, and it was really time for a new one. The navies have been changing a lot, China especially, had been really growing so much. India, of course, was bringing new aircraft carriers in, and the United States had a lot of budget cuts and a lot of changes going on since then. After the, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were winding down, so it was really a good time. And of course, you know, you had talked a lot about Russia before we went on the air, and that's another navy that's seen a lot of change.
Well, it's not just the book that you write, but you also write, I think, every month except for the month in which you put out the World Naval Navies in Review edition of Proceedings. You write a summary of what has happened in the previous month or so to the navies of the world, and which is one of the reasons, I guess, I should, you know, where I'm going here is that people should read Proceedings. I mean, you've got a terrific section in there, and then once a year you do this World Navies in Review edition, and you're responsible for summarizing everything that's happened over the past year to the navies. So let me highly recommend that to people. And speaking of that, over the past couple of years, we've seen a lot of, as we've just suggested, a lot of activity in China and other navies, but there also seems to be a lot of development of smaller navies where they're getting more active with small guided missile patrol boats and stuff. Is that just me looking at that, or is that a reality from where you're sitting?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think when you looked at navies maybe 20 years ago, you saw a lot of small boats as well, but they were gun-armed boats. And now we're seeing proliferation of a lot more missile-armed boats, patrol craft and things like that, that carry anti-ship missiles. And those can create a big threat, and they have a lot of bang for the buck, and they pack a punch because of these missiles. It creates a real problem for major navies when dealing with issues like swarm attacks by large numbers of boats that can attempt to overwhelm a destroyer or a cruiser or a warship. And so it's a challenge for a lot of the European navies and Western navies to be able to counter those. But as well, it's understanding from the smaller navies' point of view that they want to be able to operate in their home waters at short range from the shore and still be able to defend what they want to defend. So that's one of the reasons you're seeing that. So absolutely, I think it's fair to say a lot of small boats you're seeing, a lot of missile-armed craft, and you're seeing the proliferation of these missiles. Many people are buying them. You know, terrorist organizations are able to get their hands on anti-ship missiles, and new technologies being developed constantly that allow the missiles to go faster and allow them to do more damage at longer range. So that's a real challenge for Western militaries.
One thing that I'll go ahead and follow Eagle One's lead here and get you to validate one of my own assumptions. But I know we had you on last time. One of the topics that we briefly touched on was a term that I know we both like to use a lot. You know, something that we've seen after over a decade of predominantly ground warfare is a lot of sea blindness in the national security arena, and especially amongst politicians that are looking at where they want to invest and what they think is important to put towards their national defense budgets. But 2014, for a navalist, so to speak, from what I've seen, it's almost been a renaissance and a resurgence as things have come up, you know, since the fall of 2013, that has, now that perhaps the light isn't as bright on the land wars that are going on, that whether you're looking at piracy or certain navies getting additional funding or a greater appreciation of the sensitivity of disputed areas, South China Sea, for instance, and sea line of communications, there has been a renaissance of thought and discussions about the importance of how a nation carries out its national security requirements at sea. Have you seen that as well, that the attention is starting to come back where maybe it hasn't been there for a while?
Yes, I think that certainly there is a realization. Unfortunately, these realizations are oftentimes a few years later than we would have liked to see them. In Asia, for instance, the past 10 years has been a time of dramatic growth in navies in that region. It really increased power, increased investment, and increased capabilities. On the other side, among the NATO countries, we have not seen this at all. In fact, you could argue in many ways you could say the opposite. You see countries like Spain, which have gotten rid of their one of their aircraft carriers. You know, their aircraft carrier, and you can see that they're investing in lower technology ships. You know, the Dutch have a very good set of frigates, but they are really investing now in lower technology vessels. You see, the British are still several years away from getting an aircraft carrier capability, and in the meantime, they've retired their other older aircraft carriers and turned them into amphibious ships. So you're seeing that the NATO navies are suffering heavily after having been involved in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they have had to sacrifice some of that investment. They're war-weary in many ways, and so they are putting less and less into the defense industry as a whole. Contrast that to in the East with the Asian navies, and you see a very much opposite situation. So that's kind of the contrast that we're seeing. The Western navies, you know, NATO navies, are waking up to the fact of this kind of neglect that they've had in the past 10 to 15 years. But it's a slow thing because, of course, ships aren't built overnight.
Yeah, speaking of ships not being built overnight, it seems to me that, again, that looking over your stuff, that there's a rise in these large deck amphibs. You know, when we see Russia getting the Mistral from France and a lot of other nations have started putting their money into these larger helicopter capable ships, and maybe even Stovall capable ships. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There are a lot of navies that have invested in these kind of big deck amphibs, and we're talking, you know, ships that are in the range of 10 to 15,000 tons and higher, and they're pretty large. They can carry hundreds, in some cases, thousands of Marines and landing forces where they need to go, and so these vessels kind of came into vogue around in the past maybe 15 years, other than the United States using them. They kind of started to come into vogue for amphibious, the word I'm looking for is, humanitarian operations. So after a hurricane, after those kind of things, they have dual use, and that's been very popular. The other thing is they're not very expensive relative to their size to build. And the reason for that is they do not have the kind of electronics and weapon systems that are required for surface combatants like cruisers and destroyers and frigates. And it's really in many ways the electronics and the weapons that are so very expensive. It's not necessarily the steel that's expensive. So to build a large ship like that does not necessarily cost that much money depending on what you put on it. So the capabilities can always be added later, and that's one of the reasons why they're so popular. Of course, in Asia, there's been a dramatic increase in those kind of purchases because there is all of this discussion about contested waters in the South China Sea and East China Sea and Sea of Japan and all that kind of stuff in those regions. So what you're seeing, of course, is that the opportunities for marine forces and amphibious landings in those regions is taking on a whole other element of importance, much like it was in World War II, because there's these contested islands, and you're seeing that. So countries are very heavily investing in these ships that are able to land on, land forces on islands and things like that, recapture or capture islands. And, of course, they do have the dual use, the plausible deniability of saying these are meant for humanitarian operations and hospital ships, things like that.
Yeah, perhaps a question I'll bring back to the old phrase, you don't need amphibious ships anymore, not in the modern era. I was like, well, yeah, you do. You mentioned something earlier that I wanted to pull the thread on a bit, because I think it's very interesting, especially for those, if you just thought about how the U.S. builds ships, is, one of the large deck amphibs, small carrier, depending on who you're talking to, that we're looking at recently, the Canberra-class LHD for Australia. Now, it's based upon a Spanish design and was built up in Galicia in Spain up to the flight deck, and then a heavy lift brought it over to Australia to finish her out. And you also look at, you talk about the Dutch Navy, just a great support ship, the Carol Dorman class, where they're being developed, built in a similar way in Romania, which is it's a Dutch shipbuilding firm that owns the yards over in Romania. So they're building it up, doing all the for home builders the framing work, but then they're moving it over to the Netherlands to finish it up. Those are just two examples of where they're trying to build things more efficiently at shipyards, whether it's labor costs or maybe environmental regulations, they can do it cheaper. Are there other arrangements similar to what you see between the Netherlands and Romania and Spain and Australia that other companies, other countries may try to use as an example to expand their fleets more bang for the buck?
Oh, absolutely. You're even seeing it very interestingly with the United Kingdom and the Royal Navy. So they have a supply ship that they are program that they're doing that is it's called MARS, the Military Afloat Research and Sustainability Project, and it's for new oilers. And they recently announced that those are going to be built by Daewoo in South Korea, because they are far less expensive to build them there than they would be to build them in the United Kingdom. Of course, you can imagine this is the United Kingdom with a very rich history in shipbuilding, and it's really shaken things up a bit. And you can see, of course, it's also happening even with the Russian Navy, which has long had a history of building its own ships, and now, for the first time, has gone to France to say we would like to acquire these amphibious ships so that we can better land our forces where we want them to. Of course, this was a lesson learned during military operations against Georgia, and we saw also what recently happened with Ukraine and Crimea, and these are exactly the kind of forces they want, and They ordered them from France in 2011, and so far, France seems very happy to oblige. And the first one right now is on target for delivery in 2014, so it's going to be very interesting to see if they really deliver them or not. Other NATO navies have asked that they not, and said that it's not a very good idea to give these kind of capabilities to Russia. But it does show that Russia, their shipbuilding industry is not able to quickly build these ships anymore, and so they're looking to other countries. As the costs go up in certain countries and they look to other countries, those home countries very often lose the capability to build those things quickly and efficiently. And you're seeing that, and then, of course, they get transferred to other countries, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the other countries that's using that Spanish design is Turkey. They've got an amphib being developed along those same lines.
Absolutely. You're very correct.
One of the questions I have, though, is it seems kind of ironic in this time of vastly improved anti-ship missiles that navies are investing in these rather large targets, which would carry this is the same complaint that Captain Hughes has had, that if you put all your eggs in one basket, there's a danger of not having any eggs at the end of a round of firing ASMs at you. Is there a trend now where people are looking at ways to defeat these ASMs, anti-ship missiles?
Well, I think among the higher tech and higher capability navies, there definitely are. I think the other navies just don't think about getting shot at, to be honest with you. I think they just build these, most of them, for peacetime operations. Most of these large deck amphibious ships that are built outside the United States, outside of NATO countries, but mostly outside the United States, are not built to take the kind of punishment that U.S. warships are built to take. When you look at the damage that happened to the USS Stark, the frigate that was hit by an Iraqi jet in 1987.
Exocet, yeah.
Exactly. And then you look at Sam Roberts that struck a mine, and you look at a lot of, the Cole, the destroyer Cole that suffered a very serious terrorist blast in Yemen. When you look at all of those ships, thankfully, have survived. And you look at foreign warships that have had similar types of detonations, and not all of them survived. And so what that says is that U.S. shipbuilders have really been investing correctly in damage and damage control, and the ability of training of the crews has really been splendid, amazing. And you see that when foreign warships, and you look at some of the damage that was suffered by the British during the Falklands War, and the British, of course, are very, very good shipbuilders, but some of those ships were not able to take that level of damage. Now, of course, there were other examples where they did, but I think what you're looking at is U.S. ships are built to survive. They're built to take hits and continue fighting or get themselves to port or be able to save the crews. All of these things are requirements. And other countries don't look at that and don't invest in them so much. They built them oftentimes to civil standards, and they're really just not meant to take those kind of hits. They're built very optimistically. And that's the difference between the U.S. Navy and a lot of other navies, and it's often sometimes why our ships are so much more expensive, is because a lot of these countries build these ships optimistically, just assuming that no one's going to shoot at them, because a lot of them don't have enemies, and a lot of them do not put them in the kind of positions that the U.S. is faced with.
You brought up the French Mistral, which nice ship, great capability. And there's been a history where nations have built ships for another nation, and then things change, and they decide not to deliver them. You can think back to right before World War I, the UK was supposed to build and deliver a couple of battleships for the Turks, and they did not, which, of course, led to the interesting chase of the Goeben and her forgot who her destroyer was. It was with her race to Istanbul for them right before World War I kicked off. And you also had, in the late 70s, the U.S. built the four of what we wind up calling the USS Kidd class, for the Iranians, and then after the revolution decided we would keep them for ourselves, and now the Taiwanese are making good use of them. But when you look at the Mistral cell, and it is, you know, there is a big push to ask for the French to not go through it, but when you, France really isn't in a position to absorb that cost themselves. One of the stories this year has been the French senior military leadership almost to the point of resigning because of the budgetary cuts brought in by the socialist government. So they're really in no position to say, yeah, we'll go ahead and buy these big ships instead. I don't know what other nations out there, if, you know, France decided, yeah, morally we can't do this, who do you think out there might be able to pony up the money to make it a little more palatable for the French to perhaps not make that sale and sell them to somebody else?
Well, there has been talk, it's probably just talk because none of the NATO navies can really afford this, but of making them alliance assets. You know, the NATO alliance, for instance, does have warships. It has kind of observation ships right now. It also has operates E-3 Sentries, airborne warning and control aircraft. And so those are joint assets among the alliance that is used. And so there's been talk of taking these two ships that are very large, you know, 20,000 tons, you know, 210-meter ships, you know, that can be used for helicopter carriers and Stovall aircraft, that you know, converting them into NATO alliance assets. I doubt this is going to happen because these are billion-dollar warships, essentially, you know. And what we're talking about is that tremendous expense. None of the countries can really afford that, and I'm not so sure that if they invested in that money, that would be the best use of their funds because, you know, we don't necessarily need so many amphibious ships for the alliance. You know, there's not necessarily a shortage of them among NATO countries. So, of course, they're very useful because they're so big and they have such great capabilities. They have very good medical facilities on board. They have very good endurance. They have good range. They can, you know, carry hundreds of troops. So for those kind of things, they're very good. But as you said, they're also can be vulnerable if they're not protected and escorted. And you know, so I don't think it's very likely that other countries will pony up. The Dutch have not expressed interest. The South Koreans have not expressed interest in selling these to the Russians as alternates. And of course, the French, none of the countries presently that you would imagine have the finances are really in a position to do that. Perhaps you can imagine a country maybe in the Middle East, but I don't think many of them have much design on buying a big amphibious ship like this. It takes a lot of people to man it.
You know, speaking of using your money wisely, one of the other things that's been kind of interesting to me in the last few days is that the South Koreans have, I guess for a couple of years now, have been asking the U.S. to release the S-3 Viking aircraft to them because of a perceived threat from North Korea's new submersibles. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think this is a tremendous opportunity for cost saving and a wise financial decision. Essentially, the discussion is that the U.S. had S-3 Vikings, which are anti-submarine aircraft that can also were also used as kind of in-flight refueling tankers. They had very valuable maritime patrol aircraft capability to search, find, and help with search and rescue, to hunt submarines, to hunt other surface ships from the air. They have very long range. They're very fuel efficient. And they really were a mainstay of the anti-submarine and maritime patrol aircraft capabilities on aircraft carriers during the latter days of the Cold War, the 70s and 80s, and through the 90s. And I think it was really it was very sad to see these aircraft go. It was just a budget decision. They were very capable aircraft, and they had a lot of room for improvement. Unfortunately, we couldn't afford to keep them. It would have been very nice to keep them, and that they've just been in the boneyard, you know, and they just have been kind of waiting for some emergency or something like that. And so South Korea has said, you know, we obviously have a real shortage of anti-submarine capabilities. And I say obviously because a few years ago, one of their missile corvettes was sunk by a North Korean submarine, and they were not able to detect that. There's a lot of – North Korea has a tremendous capability to launch midget submarines, and they may not necessarily be the best submarines, these North Korean submarines. But they have a lot of them, and they are building more, and that's they're very covert and are hard to detect sometimes, depending on the situations they operate. So the South Koreans recognize that they have a shortage of anti-submarine capabilities, and the S-3 Vikings would be a perfect example of being able to get the best bang for your buck, as I say, and kind of like you buying a used car, it's much cheaper than buying a new one often, and these S3s have been kept in very good condition. I think this will be a very good investment, and it seems like they're going to go and order some of them.
Yeah, I agree. That would be a great thing for the South Koreans, especially with the – they have some P3s, but having the S3, the ability for it to move fast, that ISAR radar, it would be a – it'd be nice. And there definitely are some retired S3 guys that'd love to go teach them how to fly it, too. So that would be nice to see. The one of the things that came up when when we look at, what is our next small surface combatant going to be, is when you mention a couple of the foreign designs, people will come back and say, well, we would never do that for the following reasons, from, we're Americans, we don't do that, to, ouch, it's too hard. But we're doing it right now. When you look at the Sentinel class for the U.S. Coast Guard, their fast response cutter, it's based on the same people that built the Carol Dorman class for the Dutch, the Damen group in the Netherlands and shipyards in Romania. It's based upon their 4708 patrol vessel, and we're building it here just fine. How much of an open window, because I don't see one anywhere, do we look at doing kind of what the Coast Guard did with the Sentinel class, say, we don't have time to do a fresh build, but grab proven technology, proven hold system, and let's get some stuff displacing water moving forward. For the U.S. Navy small service combatant, is there any crack in a window, or have you seen anybody in uniformed or maybe even in Congress that would have an open mind to that, or is it just a fool's errand to try to push that?
Well, I think we've always kind of had this. There is a bit of a small open window. I think cost will be a very big driver, but I think also they're going to be looking very heavily at adaptability of the littoral combat ships. And I think there's a lot of the littoral combat ships, just as LCS ships, are not necessarily one thing and they're not another. So I think they kind of fumbled over themselves in that way. But being able to turn them into, at least the Freedom class, into a light frigate, I think shows a lot of promise. I think the Independence class has room for growth in terms of test platforms and in terms of has this huge hangar. It can do the other kind of things that LCS was kind of sold to do in terms of in the littorals and kind of the non-warfighting capabilities. I think perhaps you're going to see, my guess would be, the Freedom class kind of morphing more into a light frigate. You're going to see a slowdown of the speed, because that's a very expensive part of a driver, cost driver, is that 40-plus knot speed requirement. I think that's going to be reduced. If I had to guess, I think they're going to be putting VLS on, and they're going to be putting maybe a Spy 1F mini Aegis. I can envision it would be very similar to what we proposed to the Saudis and the Saudi Navy and the Israeli Navy. I think that's one of the areas, if I had to guess, what was maybe gonna happen. I think that's a very big possibility, because it allows not only to kind of jump on the back of the development, but it also allows some face saving and some kind of looking ahead and saying, look at, we were able to modify this design. It's not necessarily perfect, but I think there's a lot of room for growth in some of these ships. I do think there are foreign designs that are worth looking at, simply as a point of comparison. The trouble is, as we said, is that sometimes there are shortfalls in their ability to take hits. You know, Coast Guard ships are not necessarily designed to take hits the way Navy vessels are. And so I think you could argue some of those things. Also, by the time you're done sometimes looking at a foreign design and converting it, the cost has gone up so high that it may no longer be an option. Now, that's not necessarily saying that, you know, it's not an option. It's just saying that we have to look at those things. So is the door open? Yeah, I think you could argue that there are. It's foreign design should certainly be looked at. In the end, whether they're in the final consideration, I'm not so sure. But I think you see that there are some very good foreign warships out there. You know, but there are always going to be different priorities. And the question, of course, is can the Navy in the requirements process keep the requirements kind of tamped down so that we don't keep adding on all these gold-plated whistles that we might not need, and then we have a relatively affordable frigate that that is what many of the warfighters really seem to want and need.
You know, Captain Hughes has been spending a lot of time looking at these smaller, faster, almost single-mission, single-purpose warships. And what you're just describing, we're giving, apparently through our foreign sales program, some ambassador-class missile boats to Egypt, which seem to be really competent ships. I mean, they got Harpoon, they got rolling airframe anti-aircraft missiles. They got 3-inch guns. They're 200 feet long. They get to 2,000-mile range. You know, those are U.S. design. Why are we not looking at something like that to kind of augment our force? Is it just not fit the big Navy view of the world, or is it do you know if we're looking at that for any reason
for
U.S. purposes?
Well, I think they are good ships. I think one of the challenges is they don't have the helicopter or UAV capability to hangar our flight deck, you know, as is right now, to operate those kind of helicopters. So we're seeing that. And really, if you talk to a combatant today, a combatant commander, I think they don't want to go in. They really appreciate that long range you get, the extra set of eyes and the extra long range punch you get from having a helicopter on board or UAVs. And so that's a lacking capability right now in those. It can be rectified by making some changes and additions. But I think that, you know, that discussion about the, you know, we've seen it in the pages of Proceedings, and Hughes has been very prolific in writing about some of these. I'm not a huge fan of single-mission ships for the sole reason that imagine you're only able to take one thing with you in your car, and you have a small car. And granted, it costs less money, but imagine that you then have to go back home every time you want to change what you want to do. You can't do all your stuff at once. And that's the real problem, is that what you wind up doing is needing so many more of these ships. You know, you have to go back to port every time you want to change your missions. And your ranges are very relatively small because they aren't necessarily designed to go very far from home. And so you have foreign logistics requirements. You have to rely on foreign countries a lot and you have to get the ships to the region they want to go to. We saw this very much with the Pegasus class, guided missile hydrofoils. They were great ships. The trouble was that there was not necessarily, there turned out not to be the kind of need that they didn't fit our needs in the same way that they might have fit some of our allied needs. So, you know, Japan and South Korea invest in smaller boats because they have this kind of need to operate in their home waters. And then they're not going to take those small boats that were operating in their home waters and then turn right around and go, you know, operate in the North Atlantic. And the U.S. Navy has a requirement to do that. We have to be able to shift our ships around where we need to. That's one of the reasons why diesel submarines have never been, have not been so desired by the U.S. Navy since the advent of nuclear power, because nuclear power allows for longer range and a lot of unique capabilities. And so I think the smaller navies the smaller ships are great for smaller navies that operate in home waters. The trouble with these small ships is when they're single mission, It means you've just invested a heck of a lot of money in a ship that can only do one thing. And that's one of the reasons why LCS, I think, ran into so much trouble, is that when you make it into a multi-mission ship, it becomes essentially a light frigate, and you might as well buy a ship that's a light frigate that's designed to do that. I am cautious about ships that only do one thing, because the trouble is it's very difficult to build an affordable ship. And you go in with the best of intentions, but there's just too many things that our Navy needs to do. And if you have one ship with one mission, the trouble is it's at that moment you might need it to do anti-submarine warfare. It might be outfitted for anti-surface warfare, whereas a bigger ship can do them both. And I think that's a really key asset, and that's one of the real challenges that why I'm not a big fan of the kind of small combatants that kind of do the wolf pack fighting. And it's kind of cool thought, and it's great to think of, you know, like John Kennedy fighting the Japanese with patrol boats. But I think that the trouble is that you want to be able to do more than one mission at a time. And we can't build, it seems impossible, in my opinion, to build an affordable, inexpensive ship. So if that's the challenge that we can't do, then we might as well do what we're good at, which is building the very best ships that can do a lot of different things, even if we can't build as many of them.
You know, one part of a subject that we don't hear talked much about from a naval perspective is there was a great map that went out a few months ago about all the places we have special forces and trainers in sub-Saharan Africa compared to where we had a few years ago. And for the economics geeks, last year, Nigeria overtook South Africa as Africa's number one economy. But when you look at Nigeria, and it's always a nice number, but when you look at it, the problems that country has, a lot of people are familiar with Boko Haram, the Islamic insurgency up in the northern part of the country, and off their coast, they have significant maritime issues, whether you're talking about piracy that's taking place nearby or a little closer to the bottom line. You know, the figure I saw was last year they had $20 billion, with a B, alone of crude oil theft taking place. Have a real impressive riverine environment, but also some near-ashore considerations. And as their economy improves and a lot of their threats are involved, not only their internal waterways, but also the near abroad offshore. You know, what are we looking at in sub-Saharan Africa from a naval development point of view? And is there anything going on in Nigeria where they're looking at the maritime part of continuing to grow their economy to meet their growing population?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think, you know, we see this on the news a lot. There's piracy in that area, oil theft and attacks on shipping in local waters has really been a problem for years now, and it's not getting any better. In fact, it's getting worse. Part of the solution here, of course, there's a lot of corruption in the area, but also part of the solution is helping to expand the maritime situational awareness, the domain, you know, understanding what's in there, where people are supposed to be, and intelligence collection and integration is really important in those areas. Helping them establish a good Coast Guard, a good force, police forces that are, you know, incorruptible and able to work to kind of challenge these pirates and the organized crime and those kind of things. It's terrorists, of course, is a really big challenge. It's not easy, and so they're getting a lot of ships. Their economy, they have money, you know, to do this from the oil, and they've been. Really, the Nigerian Navy has seen a tremendous buildup in recent years. Whether they'll really be able to do this, to be able to respond quickly when a ship is hijacked, to be able to work to do this kind of stuff, it remains in question. They're certainly investing in the kind of equipment you might want them to, but whether or not the forces are able to do this, as you saw from the terrorist activities that are happening in the north, the government and the military does not always seem so motivated to solve the challenge. And so that's a real issue that in many ways is not going to be solved by just buying more ships.
Um, Well, I got a couple of great questions here for you. Let's see. One of them is the United States seems to be, we've bifurcated our fleet now. The service force is in the USNS, Military Sealift Command, and they're also taking on a whole lot of other missions. Is this a good idea?
Well, they're doing a lot of stuff to save money, and when you don't have the money, you don't have a lot of options, and I think that's what we're seeing across the board. I think money is driving everything. In a way that the Soviet threat drove everything in the Cold War, money is driving everything today. And so every decision that's being made, very often just to save a little bit of money, you know, we've all seen situations in our home and family environment where buying something just a little bit more expensive gives a whole lot more capability. And we say, you know what, it's worth that investment. Well, sometimes the government is faced with that choice, and sometimes the money just is not there. And there are situations where, you know, to just buying something a little extra gives a whole lot more capability, but we don't have the money to do that. So those kind of things, it's hard for me to say necessarily whether it's a good thing or not, because I don't necessarily think with a lot of these things there's many options, because having different manning capabilities, you know, it costs a lot of money to have a lot of sailors in the Navy. And, you know, in World War II, we had, you know, there were times we had like 300 cruisers and destroyers in the Pacific. You know, that's bigger than the whole Navy is today. And those ships take a lot of manning, and manning today, you know, when people are in the Navy, you have to, of course, pay their health care, their retirement, all those things. So I think those challenges are what we're seeing in a lot of ways, and it's not easy. And I think that's why a lot of these decisions are being made. I hope that, you know, as the economy strengthens, we'll have see more money put to shipbuilding and naval capabilities, because it certainly is a very important aspect. And, of course, not only is it important for our standing in the world, but it also is has an impact on the economy and local communities in terms of jobs with shipbuilding and you know, merchant marine and that kind of stuff. So I do think I think a lot of these decisions, as much as people might disagree with them, unfortunately, just come down to money.
Well, one place isn't having much of a money problem, at least year on year, is China. And, you know, with their economy, I think last year they had a, quote, bad year, and their economy may have only increased 7%, vice over 10%, though those numbers can be argued. But their Navy is slowly, steadily increasing in both quality and quantity. And a lot of people, you know, we've had Chinese ships not just do counter-piracy, but they've been in the Med, they've done port visits in Europe. They've come around and fiddled around in the Eastern Pacific a little bit. Is China, when you look at it from a distance, are they really trying to develop a true blue water Navy? Or are they really focused on developing a Navy that can dominate the first island chain and really be able to create the desired effects that they want to inside the second island chain?
Yes, I think that they're not there yet thinking about the true blue water Navy. Right now they're focused on, you know, the South China Sea and East China Sea, and as you said, the first and second island chains, and I think that's really where the focus is. Where they go once they have control over that area, once they feel comfortable in that area, is anyone's guess. But I do really think that the Chinese are in a very different situation than they were 10 to 15 years ago, and their growing power and their growing economic might and their growing military might has given way to a kind of boldness the world has not seen pre-Crimea days in decades. And so, you know, when I say pre-Crimea, I mean before Russia seized Crimea, this kind of activity was not so common. And so, you know, the establishment in 2013 of the Air Defense Identification Zone over contested waters, you know, the kind of push the aggressive push to kind of bring about a fight that we're seeing in a lot of areas in the South China Sea with the Philippines and Vietnam, what we're seeing with Japan and China, where they're kind of looking to for an excuse to bring a fight about. And now they're trying to, maybe you were seeing in the past couple of weeks, kind of backtracking on that maybe a little bit. They're trying to play maybe both sides, but they really, they dominate the region. And if the United States were not in the region, it would be very, very different. I mean, if you look at the charts of what capabilities navies have and air forces have in that region, China just dwarfs every other country in the region, even combined, when you look at the numbers and you look at the types and the capabilities of their ships. Now, this is not the case with Japan, where there's a little more of an even keel, and so the Japanese capabilities are very good, and that's one of the reasons why China has not completely been able to dominate that area. But I do think that China is really working to kind of change the status quo in a way so that little by little people just accept that the South China Sea and other areas are Chinese-dominated areas. And I think that's what they're trying to do. They're looking, taking pages from Alfred Thayer Mahan, and they are looking at the U.S. rise to power before World War I, around the time of the Spanish-American War, and they're using that, I think, as examples in many ways. And they are really behaving very boldly and very aggressively. And this is really creating problems. And no one really knows where this is going. There's a lot of issues. What happens if one of these countries fires back in anger at after being rammed by a Chinese ship or something? You know, those kind of issues are, in many ways, these areas are tinderboxes. And, of course, with the Senkaku Islands, the Diaoyus, as the Chinese call them, up in the East China Sea, the United States has said that they are protected under the treaties. That and while we try to not say one way or another who's which countries own which, we try not to pick a side. Those islands, we have said, are, while not saying specifically who they belong to, we have said that they fall under the treaty. So those kind of things. Of course, we also have a treaty with the Philippines. And when you look at the behavior of China against the Philippines, it's also been very, very aggressive. And I think that they're trying to draw these kind of wedges between the U.S. and Korea, South Korea, between the U.S. and Japan, between the U.S. and the Philippines, and they're trying to show that the U.S. is not necessarily going to be there to protect us, and it puts us in a very challenging area. And so they're trying to kind of do this so that it undermines our alliance and allows them also to dominate the region. They're using kind of a carrot and stick situation, and they have a lot of power because of their economy and, of course, their growing navy.
Well, speaking of growing navies and people in that neck of the woods, I mean, the Indian Navy and approach to things in the Indian Ocean and also further to the east seems to be evolving, too. What do you see the Indians doing with respect to China, and how powerful is the Indian Navy?
The Indian Navy is there was a time when the Indian Navy was exceeded the power, I think you could argue, of the Chinese Navy. They had aircraft carriers, and China did not. Of course, now China does have its own aircraft carrier and is building more. India has been a bit too reliant on Russia, I think, in my opinion, in terms of where it gets its equipment. While China has been working very hard to develop its own indigenous capability to build, design, and deliver these warships, India continues to look to Russia. And as many people know, Russia is not a very reliable arms partner. They'll promise a lot, and then when time comes for delivery, they'll need more money and more time to deliver, and they're very often very late, and they're not ready for service. We see these kind of problems with Russia in terms of the submarines they're building and the capabilities. They're just not there when they say they're going to be there. And Russia, why anyone would buy ships from Russia when, of course, Russia can't even build its own amphibious ships and has to go to France? You know, that's saying a lot. So India has kind of is still there, whether it's due to corruption and bribes or whether it's due to just the decades-long friendship between the two countries. We're seeing that a lot of, I think, a lot of India's defense challenges come from this over-reliance on Russia, which has led to their inability in many ways to smoothly design and build their own stuff. And because of that, they've really fallen behind the Chinese capabilities lately. Now, they are building their own submarines now. They're working to build their own aircraft carriers. They have the Vikrant-class air defense ship that's being built in India. They just received and now in service the modified Russian Kiev-class carrier, the Vikra, it's going to be a hard one to pronounce, Vikramaditya, I guess, my apologies to all the folks who do know how to pronounce that.
You did better than me.
Yeah, well, the challenge with the Indians, as I said, is they're going to Russia, for instance, to build, they're buying, they have leased a Nikula-class submarine from Russia. They are building an advanced technology vessel, which is kind of a mix between a ballistic missile submarine and a ballistic missile and a cruise missile submarine. So to build their first, submarine nuclear deterrent, if you will, underwater element of a nuclear triad. So they're looking to do these things. Unfortunately, we saw there was a very tragic loss of one of the Kilo-class submarines that had recently been updated in Russia. So we are seeing this, that is kind of this historic trend of getting a lot of their stuff from Russia. And whether or not where these challenges are happening, is hard to say. But I do think as they become more self-reliant with their Calcutta-class destroyers, and some of their frigates that are being built locally, I think we're going to see more progression, and I think that's going to be very good for India. I think the last of the Tall War-class frigates are entering service. Those were Russian-designed and built. And, I think that India would do very well to look to Europe more, like they have been with the Scorpene-class submarines, and look to their own capabilities to try and build those, even though it may be painful at first. I think it's very important because, as we saw with the Russian Kiev class, that the ex-Baku, the ex-Gorshkov, that now is in Indian service as an aircraft carrier, it took decades to finish. We're talking that India signed a letter of intent in 98 to acquire the ship. It arrived in 99. And the transfer of the ship to India happened in 2000. The vessel was, they planned for delivery in 2008, and it didn't even begin sea trials until 2012. In the time between 2008 and 2012, many countries have built their own ships. You look at China. China's built an aircraft carrier in that time. Although they have their own problems, they did it their own stuff, so it wouldn't really be fair to say that China built an aircraft carrier in their time. But certainly other countries have been building a lot of capable ships in those times.
Yeah, hopefully that will be the last straw for the Indians. Speaking of carriers, I wanted to get your take on, I follow, they have their own Twitter spot and they do good updates, but the Queen Elizabeth II class aircraft carrier is being built by the United Kingdom. It looks different, and the way they're procuring it is a little different, how they've kind of taken a gap year for their naval aviation side of the house. But when you look at some of the small decks, and this is obviously an upgrade from the small deck carriers you see out there, but I'm wondering, is there any discussions, not just for India, but maybe Brazil and, France originally was in on the program, but then they backed out. When these two ships are done, do you think, first of all, I just wanted to get your opinion about how the program's run at this point. And do you think there's any chance for a follow-on additional construction for maybe a country like Brazil?
Well, it's a good question. I think they do seem to be I think it's great that the British Royal Navy is going to get their naval aviation capability back. I think it's very important to have the ability to project power and bring aircraft carriers where you need them, for the simple reason of without air power, surface ships and navies are at a great disadvantage and very vulnerable. And we, of course, don't fight in our home waters. We have to take the fight to the enemy. And the British fight very similar ways that we do. And, of course, you do that through naval aviation. And if you are not able to dominate the air where your ships are fighting, you lose the war. And so you need aircraft carriers to do that. And so several years ago, the British said, essentially, we're going to have to take a strategic pause due to finances. We cannot afford to have an aircraft carrier capability right now. So they retired their aircraft carriers a couple years ago, and they said, we're going to build new ones, and they're going to come in service by around 2020. And we're going to try and buy two of them, but it could be that we can only afford one of them. And that's kind of where things are right now. There was a big debate about whether or not they would buy the conventional, regular catapult launch version of the Joint Strike Fighter or the short takeoff and vertical landing variant. And after back and forth and back and forth, they eventually decided on the short takeoff and vertical landing variant because that gave some flexibility and also because there was less risk involved in a lot of ways, and the cost, depending on who you ask, was lower. So I think that was a good decision. I think the question, though, of whether or not they have one or two is still up in the air. They hope to have two, but I definitely see that if they decide to only have one in operation, there could be, I could imagine that they could sell it to, for instance, something like Brazil. I could imagine that happening. But I do think that it's also possible they decide to maintain that fleet of two aircraft carriers, which would be great because then they can always have a carrier ready. They're really good carriers, I think they're going to be. I think they're going to have about 40 aircraft total, including the Joint Strike Fighter B variant, the Stovall variant, as I said, Merlin helicopters, Chinook helicopters. I think it's going to be great. They're 65,000-ton ships. They're going to be pretty big, about the size of the Forrestal class aircraft carriers that the U.S. operated in the Cold War. And those are, you know, not to be sneezed at. They're pretty sizable ships, 284 meters we're talking about, and they have a sizable flight deck for they will not have catapults. But as I said, the Joint Strike Fighter B variant, I think, is a very capable aircraft. Of course, it's not, doesn't have the range, and it lacks some of the capability that the C model and the A model have. But it also does give that flexibility that I think is very unique. And I think for the United States especially, the Italians are also very interested in it for their aircraft carriers. But I think for the United States especially, it gives a very, very good capability because it allows our big deck amphibs to kind of be mini aircraft carriers, and it allows our big deck aircraft carriers to be where they're most needed. And there are little areas, there might be areas where we don't need necessarily to have a full deck aircraft carrier there, but we might want to have the capability to operate fixed-wing aircraft, and the B model allows us to do that.
Eric, this has been a really fast hour. I've got about 300 more questions to ask you, so we just keep going. No, what I want to do is I want to thank you for coming on and find out what you've got going on. And, you know, we need to have you on more often because probably at least every March, right, when you write that World Navy Review.
Yeah, World Navy's in Review.
We can talk. Yeah, so perhaps we can look forward to that in the future. In the meantime, what else do you have you got going on and work? Have you worked on any articles and stuff where people can go look at, or is it just the Proceedings
Well, of course, Proceedings
update,
Magazine.
So.
Yeah, Proceedings Magazine is where I do pretty much all my stuff when I'm not doing the next edition of Combat Fleets. People can check out Combat Fleets by going to combatfleets.com or, of course, going to navalinstitute.org or usni.org. That's a great website. I just recently finished giving a keynote speech at MacArthur Memorial Week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's kind of his second home there. He grew up a lot during his childhood years, General MacArthur there. And I talked about the Pacific military situation today. So a lot of the speakers there, of course, were discussing what happened during the Philippines, you know, during the return of the Philippines and what was happening during the early days and later days of World War II, and I kind of said, okay, here's where we were in 1945. Here's what the situation looks like today. And thankfully, it was very well received, I think, because we do face a lot of threats in the Pacific especially, and we're seeing rising challenges to the kind of the status quo, and we're seeing a lot of challenges, and the next couple of years are going to be very interesting from a naval perspective.
Well, perfect. Really thank you, and appreciate the time you're taking this afternoon to come with us, Eric. And we do look forward to next time, but hey, have a great summer.
Thank you. You as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Eric.
And thanks everybody, for joining us today, especially those on the archive. Please join us again next week for another live edition of MIDRAT, where our guest is going to be Major Matt Cavanaugh, U.S. Army. He is the Assistant Professor at West Point in Defense and Strategic Studies. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Cheers.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye. Farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.